Noah, what is the key insight?
Hexapodia is the key insight. 6 feet.
And what is that supposed to mean?
That there is often some key nugget of fact that, if you grasp it correctly, will allow you to transform your view of the situation and grok it completely.
And in the work of the mind-bending science fiction author, alas, now the late science fiction author Werner Vinge, in his novel A Fire Upon the Deep, the point of Hexapodia is.
That those sapient bushes riding around on six-wheeled scooters have been.
Programmed to be spies and evils for the spies and agents for the great evil.
But today, unfortunately, we discuss the passing of the man who gave our podcast his name, Werner Vinge, who
Yes.
passed away recently.
Yes. Sorrowfully true. That. It is depressing that someone who gives you, as me, so much pleasure, so much excitement, so much enjoyment, even though my relationship with him was totally parasocial, is now no longer with us, and is no longer to be creating new, extraordinarily bizarre, weird, and mind-bending and provocative ideas. On the other hand, for a male, 80 is a very good run.
Not terrible, but
Especially if you're born in 1944.
that's true. Born during World War II.
And indeed, it's likely that, that for humanity considered as an anthology intelligence, his works, his words, his ideas are going to be part of it. Not until the end of time, but at least as long as our particular civilization survives. People are going to be thinking about the singularity, and in my view, probably about why it did not happen. That's going to serve as an arch for understanding a lot of what goes on, went on in the next century. That people thought we were approaching a singularity, and yet it did not come.
That's an interesting
So,
point of view, given that
yes.
generative AI has exploded upon the scene. And many techno-optimists believe that we are now seeing the technological singularity unfold in real time in the news around us.
So he will be part of us. We're us as humanity as an anthology intelligence, for a very long time to come. Which do you want to talk about first?
Well, let's talk about the singularity. So
Yeah.
this And that, because that includes both true names and the nonfiction, the coming technological singularity. So, in true names, Werner Vinge is, some people think he invented cyberpunk. I think it was more an accumulation of small inventions. But true names basically has godlike AIs duking it out in cyberspace, represented as wizards. Basically, by trying to grab more computing power from each other. And I think that this foresees generative AI. It's not just that it foresees a singularity, but I think it nailed some of the aspects of generative AI, even though Werner Vinge had no idea how that would be accomplished or the mechanics. He didn't know that it would be deep learning, essentially a large, layered logistic
Neural net.
regression. Or the transformer model. He had no idea about any of these things, but he sort of nailed the some of the particulars, that AI would be all about compute. It's all about how much compute you can grab, and that compute will be a general purpose commodity like oil that you can just sort of grab and repurpose.
That you don't know who you're talking to, and the mailman is trying to grab all the computer power in the world and become omnipotent, ascend to godlike power by controlling the network of computers on which humanity's life otherwise depends.
Pretty
And
much.
all of this is built on top of, I a deliberate casting of the internet to be of virtual reality as he did not know it, very much in the form of the relationship between the human world, between Middle Earth and the land of Faerie. In that they must navigate challenges in both the real and the Fey worlds in order to prevent the evil Fey from ascending the godlike power. And in the end, they succeed in disrupting the mailman's network.
Right.
Wondering what's going to happen next.
Evil AI is disrupted, ultimately.
Yes. And evil AI is also, I don't want to say much smarter than we are, but much more manipulative than we are, you know, able to foresee future consequences of its actions to an alarming and astonishing degree. Right? That is, there is no chaos in the world as the mailman sees it. It tries to push us down particular paths and is able to see 20 moves ahead of everything that we are doing. In a way, the analog is that intelligence and human life is very much like chess, where the key thing is to make an innocuous move now that will have powerful consequences, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 moves down the way that, you know, the limited human with their small intelligence cannot see, you know. And so, you know, the humans, even all the humans working together, are potentially outwittable. If the mailman actually gets enough computing power in order to become this right. truly super intelligent entity.
And I know our general rule is not to explain anything that we talk about, but the mailman is the evil AI.
The mailman is the evil AI, yes. And yet, whenever I run into ChatGPT, what I wind up thinking is that this thing, or into Gemini, or into Claude, I wind up thinking this thing is very loquacious, in the words of Alex Krantz of The Verge. But it is not at all intelligent. When it is intelligent, it is simply landing on intelligence by virtue of its existence as a stochastic parrot. But then again, when I land on intelligence, it's often because of my existence as a stochastic parrot as well. And my view is that in a world in which there's an awful lot of chaos and in which foresight is very limited, the kinds of ideas that something that can think faster than we can outsmart us in any way greatly, greatly to our detriment. That's a hard lift for me to make. On the other hand, I look at the number of people who get easily addicted to gambling, one form or another, and I look at the amount of money that, you know, Facebook and Google managed to extract, and Apple too managed to extract out of humanity by doing things that really shouldn't be such sources of enormous, enormous excess value, that they really should not be able to keep their prices that far above marginal cost for as long as they have. And yet there's every indication that they are going to be able to keep doing so indefinitely. I have to wonder whether my grasp of how humanity works is really accurate or not.
Well, so you're likening monopoly power, the monopoly power of tech companies. You know, the tech companies themselves are sort of like a collective intelligence that has slow moving collective intelligence. Google has convinced us to give it all our search ad revenue, and Apple has convinced us to give it all our app purchase revenue, and somehow they've convinced us to do this. And that represents some sort of outwitting of humanity. As my grandmother used to say to me, if that's the worst thing that ever happens to you, you're gonna have a great life.
And then I would talk about Purdue Pharmaceuticals, which is a slow moving AI of considerably more malign no impact in deciding that the way for it to, that its strategy is to addict as many people as it can to OxyContin.
Right.
And I'd say that, simply curbing the excess profits of the tech platform monopolies is something that humans ought to just do as a matter of course, simply by being willing to experiment with other search engines, other hardware platforms, other social networks, other, and yet the Googles, the Facebooks, the Apples are able to corral us, in such a way that, the benefits they get from their increasing returns are sufficient that we are never able to escape, or never able to escape in large enough numbers, that there is serious market force competitive erosion, of their profits. Although Google fears there may well be, right? Google pays Apple $26 billion a year, just so that Apple does not give you a random search engine, in Safari when you sign on to your iPhone. Just so that the default is Google rather than the default being something we pick at random today. And that's an awful
Yeah.
lot of money.
Fair enough. So,
But
let's get
you've been
back. Let's
spending
stop
you
talking about monopoly companies
know,
for a second. Talk
yeah,
to
but you've
talk
been
about Vern and
spending more
Mitch.
time in the belly of the Cerebral Valley House, AGI beast than I have this spring, because I've been off here in Berkeley teaching economic history essentially full time.
I see you read the article on the two AGI houses.
I did indeed. I did. I
What,
did. I
neither
did.
of those are in Cerebral Valley. They're both far away.
Why are neither of them in Cerebral Valley?
They're too big. There's no
Okay.
houses that big here.
Okay.
Here in
And
Cerebral
they
Valley, we have
decided they
a
didn't want to
several
buy,
houses.
they didn't want to buy a block in Cerebral Valley because that would be too expensive and that they didn't really need to be exactly there.
Correct. And also they have lots of negative stereotypes about living in a city, fear of crime and stuff that are not really necessarily
Really?
accurate. Although I will say that some of the people that organized one of the AGI houses
Yeah.
had organized a house right in Cerebral Valley that was a very large house that did a whole lot of drugs and had a blow up over sexual harassment.
Oh, okay.
So,
All right.
which, it really strikes me how much sort of hacker houses
Yeah.
recapitulate all the problems of co-ops and punk houses,
Yes.
but with money. Because you take people about the same age and you just add a whole lot of money.
Right. So you had hippies, and then you had punks, and now you have hacker houses,
Right.
and these all repeat the same things, only with more
Yes.
style in the case of punk and more money in the case of hacker houses.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I have lived in all three, so
Right.
I can compare. But anyway, I think getting back to Vinge, whose name is actually technically pronounced Vinji, but we've just decided to culturally appropriate it and call him Vinge
Right.
because it sounds
Yep.
great.
Yep.
So he talked about the singularity, and he wrote, he coined that term. It was not a Kurzweil. In fact, Vinge, when he talked about the singularity, meant something like what earlier people had talked about with the intelligence explosion, or I forget. I think the first person to mention the possibility of this kind of thing was Leibniz, right? He said, if you get a machine smart enough, it'll make itself smarter. And so this idea of
Yes.
a self-bootstrapping intelligence. Now, the thing about the idea, there's basically two ideas to the singularity concept. Those two ideas are, number one, that intelligence bootstraps itself, so that intelligence creates greater intelligence, and
Right.
the time interval required for intelligence to create greater intelligence of a certain step size shrinks with the degree of intelligence, meaning that
Yes.
intelligence proceeds along an explosive curve.
Right.
And so, in other words, if you make a smart machine, it'll make a smarter machine faster than the last smart machine made the next smart machine. And so the intelligence explosion is the first idea of the singularity. And the second idea is that this intelligence explosion will lead to completely unpredictable, fabulous progress in other areas of technology other than intelligence itself. The idea
Right.
that once you get this godlike intelligence, it will invent much better chemistry and material science, and it'll understand neurotech, and it'll create nanotech, and it'll, do all these things, and it'll basically understand the world very rapidly. And so I
Where
think.
intelligence is not just having a lot of people trying different things and saying which one works, but intelligence is seeing much, much further down the game tree in some sense.
Perhaps.
Where intelligence is seeing 40 moves ahead in the chess game.
Well, in AI, you do have beam search, right? So this is beam search is sort of like, I always did think of intelligence as being sort of like a light beam and distinct, and the intelligence being the strength of your light beam, which is distinct from how wide of a beam it is or where you point it. So, but I think both of those ideas of that singularity are subject to question. Like both of those are things that I would say, well, is that really true? Even with generative AI, even with all that progress, I think we still don't really know whether those two basic ideas are true. The idea of whether intelligence creates greater intelligence at a faster and faster rate is not necessarily true because I just think that the objective functions that humans require to create generative AI and to create classic computing, pre-AI computing as well, those objective functions are not necessarily there for AI. Even if the capability were there, which I think we're not sure, it's not clear whether AI wants to create greater AI or whether that's something that humans did because, we were, apes who thought that creating greater AI would get us laid more.
Well,
Because
at the moment, AI really isn't advanced enough to do to create much of anything.
well, maybe not,
But
but
it's,
even if it were, even if it were, I think that you also have to take into account the question of why would it? Is it because humans tell it to and it'll do anything we say? So it's
That,
not much of an AGI, is it?
So that there's this assumption that there's some kind of identity between an AI attempting to bootstrap itself and the higher intelligence that is not necessarily found with monkeys deciding on what to do next.
Right.
Now, there is the fact that that human intellect, that human progress really does look like a hockey stick, as I talk about a lot, in my big book, Slouching Towards Utopia. That is, that the rate of technological progress starts out extremely, extremely low. And then in the Middle Ages, reaches the in the long term, amazing height of 5% per century. Up until 1500, and then doubles to 15% per century after 1500, and then to 44 or to 44% per century. Or actually, that the exponent matters then. 44 plus 54% in the 1770, 1870 Industrial Revolution century, before hitting 2% per year in the century and a half since 1870. There is a secular rise in the rate of growth of human technological potential, at least until we seem to hit our plateaued growth rate after 1870, after which there has not been much action. And so you could very well say that the next phase is going to be another step up. When we figure out how to tune a significantly larger share of our power as an anthology intelligence to useful research and development on non-rival, non-excludable things. And we will manage to do that someday, and one of the major pieces of that may well be AI. And that since we've had three big triplings since 1500, it's reasonable to expect a fourth. Which would then mean that humanity's technological competence would double every 10 years, which would mean that Doubling every 10 years means it grows a thousandfold in a century. What that form that would take is not something we can imagine, but that looks some damned close to singular. And the
Right.
only argument against that seems to be that we are going to run up against true limits in the sense of how much we can compute and how much we can communicate and how much we can unlock additional ways of manipulating nature. That we've kind of
Correct.
gotten most of the way there so far, and now the low-hanging fruit is gone. The fruit that's going to, we're going to harvest in the future is very high-hanging indeed. And humanity's technological competence is going to logisticize rather
Right.
than exponential or super exponential.
Right. It's possible, so I guess this is what Cosmas Chalizi postulates in the
Right.
singularity in our rearview mirror, which I think he wrote
Right.
in mid-2000s, right?
So there is a big deal about ex logistic versus exponential versus super exponential here. And that simply, what can we do?
Right.
What will
Now,
we be able to do?
I have a another thought as well, which is that the idea of utility utility is monotonic. Utility is, I'm sorry, utility is ordinal. And so any monotonic transformation of utility will keep it the same
You can say, you can
for
say,
Boyce theory.
you can pose thought experiments about what kind of person would you prefer to be with what odds, and then claim that decision making under risk gives you a cardinal measure. But that's
You
an
can do that.
extremely dodgy thing to do.
Right. Yes. Let's not get into Rawls quite yet, but let's say that I do think that if technology gets humanity to a bliss point, then local non-satiation is basically thrown right out the window. Then we have to change how we think about these things because, then basically it's instead of we need instead of our typical thinking is that because utility is concave, we need exponential growth to keep getting happier at a linear rate. But basically we're dealing with a log linear thing there. We need exponential growth to keep being linearly happier. That's the basic log utility
And this is because
argument.
our brains, in some sense, are naturally built to a log scale
Something like
in
that,
our
yes.
pleasure centers.
Or yes, but well, yes, or that any specific consumption good will have this, and there's a finite number of consumption goods, and there is that. But okay, so but I'm saying suppose we toss that and think that there is a ceiling, and we're just heading toward a ceiling. Then you can define progress toward that ceiling. If you define progress, your distance from that ceiling transformed as your sort of objective function, then you can have what looks like a singularity because when you go to in infinity is we redefine infinity as hitting the ceiling. So, a lot depends on how we define the objective function of humanity. And I think that we are approaching what I consider the ultimate innovation.
What do you think is the ultimate innovation?
The ultimate innovation is the ability to control human personality desi and desires, to the ability to control human desire. I think that a human, like a particle, is defined entirely by what it seeks, by the forces that act upon it, and how much they move it. The scattering matrix defines humans just as it defines particles. And I think that
Now,
what the fundamental thing about what it means to be human is what a human tries to do and wants. And so, and if we change that, we can change humanity to be basically anything. And in the old days, people thought that the ultimate technology was faster than light travel because it would allow us to colonize the universe the way we'd colonize the Americas.
Right.
Australia, and we would just exploit resources until, infinitely. And then people thought, okay, well, maybe the ultimate technology is actually virtual worlds where we can upload ourselves, and that's the Kurzweiling singularity, an idea that we can create any world we want. Why go exploring for other worlds that already exist when we can just create a new world? And then I go one step further, and this idea, I've seen it in Philip K. Dick, Greg Egan, and other places, but the basic idea is why create better worlds for ourselves when we can feel any way that we want about the world that already exists? And I quote the respected philosopher Sheryl Crow in her treatise Soak Up the Sun, who saying, it's not getting what you want, it's wanting what you've got.
One could also drop a footnote here to the Buddha,
Indeed.
or to Marcus Aurelius, or indeed Zeno of Citium around the year 300 BCE. That what is a proper life well lived for a human being, is something that people have been discoursing about for a long, long time, right? Indeed, I still think the best thing that ever has been written on this is philosopher Alistair MacIntyre's. I think it was the first book he ever wrote, A Short History of Ethics, about how it all basically comes down to the Greeks, because the Greeks were the first people to have their society thoroughly destabilized, by contact with outside, the development of a multiple city-state culture, and so forth. And it was before, in Mycenaean or in post-Bronze Age, Dark Age times, it was obvious, what a good noble was, what a good warrior was, what a good woman was, what a good child was. There were these ascribed social roles that were given by the gods, into which people were slotted into. And a good warrior was fearless, brave, clever enough not to get into too many fights they were likely to lose, and willing to give away some of the booty he got to his followers. But then you enter a more complicated world, and all of a sudden you have Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and even before then Homer, asking, but what makes a good man? What makes a good woman? What makes it, what is good for the human being as itself, as opposed to the human being trapped or slotted into the particular social role that corresponds, to their place in a largely static society.
Right.
We're off and running. I won't say that Plato and Aristotle had terribly good answers to it, but they were asking the question. That is the question that any time you get more than enough social power to organize yourselves and to manipulate nature, so that you simply don't have to worry about the first order problems of, am I going to eat tomorrow? You then start getting this, what should I do? The singularity is that in spades.
Right. But I think that what Vinge missed was the idea that utility itself is a control variable. I think that this is what, Greg Egan has touched on this a lot, and Philip K. Dick touched on this. And I think that I don't know why Greg Egan came up with this, but for Philip K. Dick, it was because he changed his personality with drugs a number of times and realized that you could become a completely different person if you did a whole bunch of drugs in a punk house, And so, that's topic for another day, but I think that, for Vinge, he was in awe of intelligence as intelligence. And when you go into his far futures, you rarely see how the people live. You don't really see the payoff or what this intelligence is for. In A Fire
Well,
Upon the Deep,
the payoff for the evil AI,
is right. The evil AI
is
wants
that it
directions and
constructs that it somehow constructs a way to get around the the center of the galaxy spanning radiation that disrupts transhuman cognitive processes close into the core of the galaxy.
right.
And so as a result, is able to take over lots and lots and lots of things and make them part of it.
Yes.
But there's no idea of what it is doing at all. Other than
Right.
that,
It is the black box of techno-fascism.
other than that, the powers that truly exist in the beyond are evanescent, because they do everything that they want to do, and then they somehow go off the rails and vanish,
But
right?
in the series of A Fire Upon the Deep,
Yeah.
when there's really no theory of human happiness other than, what if all my dogs were just one dog? Like that's
And I
really,
control them, and I control them.
well, maybe, but what if all my dogs were one really smart, were combined to one really smart dog? And that's great, because I actually think that having pets is a very important key to happiness. And so I think that the fact that Fire Upon the Deep has dogs is great. And the
Even
universe isn't
super intelligent
necessarily
dogs.
a super intelligent dog remains floofy and you can still hug. And
Yes.
I think
And in
that's a
fact,
deeper
there are
point than
five of
people
them.
realize.
There are five of them in a pack.
Right.
Five times the dog.
Yes, five times the dog. And so,
And
but.
you remember what? It's the movie Up that the dog talks, or the dog has an AI assistant that helps it talk.
Right.
Except in, but most of what it says is squirrel, agreed.
Yes.
But still, AI is going to get us there. If we wanted to do a startup, I would recommend the startup would be to build expert systems that we would hang around the necks of our pets like pendants that would form a mapping between their behavior, their mental state, as we can indicate it from their body temperature, alertness, and so on and so forth, and various words.
Oh yeah.
And so give your rabbits, my dogs, everyone's cats a vocabulary of 1,000 words or so.
Yeah, it's called Pet Pulls, PETPULS.
Yes, but the things I've seen are things where the pet actually has to step on a tile on the floor
Oh, that too.
and
But
you train
there's a
it.
South Korean company that's making this.
Okay. How much does it cost?
Actually, that's a great question. How much does it cost? So,
And do they
pet
have a rabbit
poles,
version?
not yet. Rabbits harder. Because rabbits don't have necks is the problem.
Okay.
A pet poles smart collar, you can get one for about $80. Of course the technology will get much better, but
Yes.
I do want this. I do want telepathy. I think that there's so many things that AI could do to fundamentally alter the human condition. And I feel like
Well,
the internet was something that even the cyberpunks didn't predict very well most of the time. They predicted the internet, but they predicted more like, VR environments or sort of like just file trees or something. It wasn't necessarily like this. They didn't predict social media. Social media and
No,
mobile
no,
social
no.
media was something that no one predicted, and yet it ch fundamentally changed the
No, they
nature of human
predicted.
experience and society
Yeah,
just
they
really
went
fundamentally.
back, somehow they all went back to early modern Europe, late medieval Scottish fantasy. The fact that the MIT produced leading computer science textbook has a wizard on its cover, for decades upon decades.
Yes.
The close analogies between computer programming and the magic of Paracelsus and of John Dee and so forth. It was very much that people who control code can become wizards, explicitly wizards, as in Unix wizard.
Right.
And perhaps that the internet will be a realm of virtual reality like fairy, strangely perilous and strangely beautiful, of which cyberpunk is only one kind of modality, was what they headed for, and they did not head for the universal library and gossip fest and video channel, that we have today.
Right.
Right.
And yet it changed us. It didn't show up in the productivity statistics in a major way, and yet it
Yeah, it
changed
should
what it
have.
means to be a
It
human
should
being.
have. It should have, right? It didn't show up. It didn't show up because so much of the value was not excludable.
Yeah,
And that
Chad
rather
Cyberson
than
thinks
actually,
it did show up.
yeah, rather than actually charging for, charging people for what was the actual useful thing that people were doing, and thus getting maybe half of the use value as market value, we only got charged for the advertising and only got a tenth, of the use value as market value.
Right.
No?
No, I think Chad Cyberson's probably right about this.
Why do you think he's right about this?
Well, first of all, because I think a lot of the so internet stuff replaced, in people's time use, it replaced TVs and things like that, which
Yeah.
also had a similar amount of consumer surplus,
No, yeah,
which
but
also
then
had a whole bunch of, and then,
the real thing is the coming of radio to consume people's leisure time for with something that
sure.
doesn't cost money, and then
Right. But
TV
that progress
and
happened a
whatever.
while
Yeah.
ago, is the point.
And
So
then TV
the
with
switch to social mobile, blah, 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 was, it was a change in kind, but not necessarily a change in how happy people were. The other main thread of research, I think, that calls into question this narrative, which is the Eric Brynjolfsson narrative that you were just saying of
Right.
all this uncaptured consumer surplus.
Yeah.
The other contradiction is the idea of toxic network effects and the fact
Yes.
that we're starting to get research results, several research results that say that basically people would pay not to have to give up Instagram, but would pay a lot of money to have everyone else give up Instagram so they didn't have to hang out there all the time. And so the idea that I'm here, I don't want to be the only person without Instagram because then I'm cut off from human society, but God damn it, I wish human society weren't based around Instagram. And this toxic network effect massively reduces consumer surplus. And I saw one recent paper, there's the Genscow paper, but there's a recent paper suggesting that the total consumer surplus of social media in total is negative because of the toxic network effect. And
Who's
I don't
that
remember who
by?
the authors of those were.
Can you
Let me.
send it to me afterwards? If you remember, if you find it.
I can look it up right now. Social media, toxic network effects. Let's hope Google still works a little bit. It's
Yes, hasn't been SEO'd into oblivion.
oh God, Google's so bad now. Collective traps. Oh, I found it. Google actually worked for something.
Okay.
And the reason I didn't remember the name of these people is because the authors are Beknazar Yuzbashev, Jimenez Duran, and Stalinsky.
Okay. So
Comrade Stalinsky is in the house.
it's called collective traps.
It is called a model of harmful yet engaging content on social media.
Ah, okay. That's the subtitle or the title?
That is the title.
Okay.
Let's look at collective traps, social media. And I think that Cyberson didn't even. Oh no, I'm sorry. That's a theory paper. No, this is the paper that I actually wanted. This is the empirical paper. The paper I actually wanted is by Burst I can't even spell that. Burstyn, Handel, Jimenez, and Roth. It's called When Product Markets Become Collective Traps: The Case of Social Media.
Okay.
That's the actual empirical paper about this idea. When product markets become collective traps.
The case
So
of
ignore the other paper is just theory, so I would ignore that paper.
And simply saying we've seen this before in opium and the opium wars, and we've seen this before in gambling and Las
Actually,
Vegas.
no. This is
No?
not that. This thing is not that thing. They are two different things. The
They are
idea
both.
is individually, you would not consume. So, opium is a thing done by yourself. Gambling is a thing done by yourself. If you've ever seen a person at a slot machine,
Yes.
it is
Yeah.
not a network effect.
Yes.
It is an addiction effect is not network effect.
Okay.
Instead, what we're talking about here is a network effect where almost everyone would prefer to do things in smaller groups.
Yes.
But when smaller groups are not available, because all you can get is this large group. So, let's see, what does it say? The fear of missing out.
Yes.
Individual, so the closer, the actual analogy is luxury brands. Everybody's got a Gucci bag, so I need a Gucci bag too.
Yes. And this is my problem set about how if about how each and about how a Stanford student who buys and drives a BMW convertible around campus enjoys it, but everyone else feels somewhat envious. And so the right equilibrium is to ban BMW convertibles from the Stanford campus, and in fact, return the entire Stanford campus to the Spartan diet of black broth.
Well, yes. So I think what we're dealing with really is a particular kind of social preference. You take social preferences, you add network effects, you get crap. And so I think that social media changed our world, but it did not, in some ways it changed it for the better, but I think that in many ways it changed it for the worse, and we're now figuring out how to get away from that. I actually think TikTok is a way we're starting to try to get
Get
away from that,
away,
because TikTok
yes.
is closer to traditional TV. It's like
Although,
watching TV was a way for people in the 70s to unplug from the street protest movements and of like all the street chaos of the late 60s and early 70s. You know, if you just tune that out, stayed in your house and watched some push media, you watch, you know, I've always wondered my whole life why, you know, when I was a little kid in the 80s, I was born in the 80s, and when I would, as a little kid, I would see all these cartoons, and 80s were like this wacky, weird time. Everybody loved weird shit,
Yes.
weird media, but mostly push media. Everyone would stay in their rooms and read Nintendo Power, you know, and you know, listen to like The Cure or later Nirvana or whatever. And people were all in so much into push media, the into things that they consumed by themselves. And I wondered
They didn't
why.
play Dungeons and Dragons.
They played Dungeons and Dragons, but it was in a small group. You weren't,
Yes.
you know, a
Right.
few people would go to the big conventions, but even then it was, you know, a vertical of shared interest. And as we moved into the era of the early internet, as we moved into the 90s, people started collectively gathering in groups again. But I always attributed it purely to the technology of the day and thought that, oh, we didn't have the internet, so of course everyone just sat there and consumed push media. But now I think there may have been a social feedback process there where the unrest that existed from 1965 to maybe 1970, you know, three or two or so, that unrest caused a lot of America to retreat to push media, where they didn't have to, you know,
Perhaps.
go out in the street and fight people, and you know, maybe the street was our social media in the six in the you know the 60s and 70s, and people went inside their rooms and you know, like consumed all this weird stuff, and you know, I don't know, because that was a way of getting away from there. And then later generations forgot. They forgot, why am I sitting in this room doing nothing, doing, you know, just like playing video games and listening to music and watching TV. Why am I doing this? There's lots of other people who like the same things I like. Maybe I could get involved in an anime fandom. Maybe I could get involved in a Star Trek fandom online, or maybe I could get involved in all these things. So people created all these collective spaces in the early internet. Then Mark Zuckerberg and company came along and monetized that by creating collective spaces that were even more participatory. And the Eternal September happened for social media. And then you know, everyone and their dog had something to say about, you know, who was running the Star Trek fandom and who was running the D&D game and who, you know, and so all the toxic social effects of, you know, large group, all, whole society collectivism came back via social media, and were, of course, they're monetized by Zuckerberg, but the more important thing was that they came back, and instead of just a few nerds hanging out talking about, you know, Star Trek and anime, it was, you know, everyone and their dog taking the nasty, pernicious water cooler gossip of earlier decades and applying it to online spaces at scale. And so
What I get
that,
from this is that you're still spending too much time on Twitter.
well, yes.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, Eternal September is a serious problem. You know, the analogy I keep referring to is that, you know, an individual human is like a neuron. Humanity as an anthology intelligence is like a bug. and the coming of Sophocleia is like caffeine. And if only we as an anthology intelligence had a sophisticated enough liver to process the caffeine and get it out of the bloodstream before it killed us, we would not be in our current state of near bug death from caffeine, from virtual caffeine poisoning via social media. And we will figure out how to handle this. We will figure out to handle this just as early modern Europe figured out how to handle the coming of the printing press.
I and agree.
You no longer had the greatly restricted slow flow of ideas.
I agree.
We that will someone learn how like to handle
Copernicus
it,
but we're at the
could
beginning
actually
of this.
have, you know, that Copernicus and Tycho Brahe and so forth, and then Newton could actually have a lot of books about astronomy and say, what do all these things have? What can I learn from them all? Rather than feeling very lucky to just have a single book.
Right. Now let's go back to Vinge. Let's bring it back. In Vinge, what happens when you network? When you network the in Fire Upon the Deep, what happens when you network the whole world? It becomes vulnerable to the fascism virus, the blight, which takes over everything and turns everybody into a little pawn of blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
Now look at social media.
And you
look
say
at,
that
look at who controls TikTok and look at who controls Twitter.
You say this is a not unreasonable metaphor.
Yes. The blight is just, you know, China, Russia, MAGA, and all that shit. And there's this, I think Anne Applebaum wrote The Propaganda War. I think people are starting to wake up. People are starting to see. She wrote, a day ago, she wrote, Russia and China are winning the propaganda war. And she said, autocrats in China, Russia, and elsewhere are making common cause with MAGA Republicans to discredit liberalism and freedom around the world. And they're doing that using the tool of social media. That is the blight. That's the blight right there. The blight is taking over our world through the because we linked our brains to the, you know, to the global network, and then a bad actor invaded the global network. And that's the blight is real. And what even Vinge didn't foresee was that the blight would convince people that the blight was the good guys. But that we never really get to see what people lived like
we
under the
don't
blight.
see, no, but they certainly think they're the good guys, right?
Someone said, someone who saw people living under the blight said, it seemed like everybody was just someone's fingers.
Yes.
And often I feel that people on social media are the fingers of bad actors.
Yeah, that they're stochastic puppets, parrots who do not, they're stochastic parrots who are puppets who do not know why they are saying what they are saying.
Right.
Or even where it comes from. Now we then get to, they then get to a deepness in the sky where the big bad is not something that hacks your brain via the network. So you can do its will, but where the big bad is a surveillance state.
Right.
Trying to play a game of lurk and pounce so that they will ultimately come up with owning everything in the star system and be able to completely rebuild their civilization after the disaster that they created for themselves by launching a war when they weren't quite powerful enough to actually do a smooth takeover.
The emergence, they're called.
And of course, it all worked, the emergence. Who we think for the entire book, they're called the emergence because they're emerging from a dark age into a new bright Renaissance civilization. And no, they're not. They're called the because they're the people who declared an emergency and took over the solar system through that and then created these particular biotechnologies that allow them to run a surveillance state.
Indeed. Yes.
And in the end, they lose. But the only reason they lose is that the planet of aliens that they're trying to take over in part of their three-cornered fight between the with the bad humans, the good humans, and the aliens, that the species of aliens on the planet that they're trying to take over happen to be a race of spiders. And you should never attempt to engage in a strategic game of lurk and pounce.
With a game of spider.
You know, that to add to that, you'll never go up against a Sicilian when death is on the line.
When death is on the line.
Never a game of lurk and pounce with a race of spiders.
Right. So I love Deepness. I like Deepness in the Sky better than A Fire Upon the Deep, honestly.
So do I.
Fire Upon the Deep is wackier and more far out.
Fire on the Deep is cool. But the big bad is too opaque. And I'd say the big bad in A Deepness in the Sky is not sufficiently well fleshed out to be truly real, but it's much more real than the Blight. And that
Right.
helps the book a lot.
And Pham Nguyen is a human character that we can sympathize with instead of a reconstructed composite of several humans who has, uncertain history, personality, and motivations.
I actually sympathize.
I
No, there
like
are
what
two.
the
There are two
reconstituted
camps.
Pham
Yes,
says about what it
yes.
means to be an individual, but it's not as easy to relate to him. Whereas in A Deepness in the Sky, you really get to know him and what he wants and what his background is, and you get to see him as a person, not just as some sort of like
Yeah.
larger than life space hero.
Well,
I like that anyway.
I actually like the Pham of A Fire Upon the Deep, somewhat more, because he is not a person. He is pieces of four or five people put back together called Pham Nguyen, and has a brain and history and memories that do not quite coalesce as a personality.
Right.
Plus the fact that the real reason he exists, he has been created, is precisely so that a dead superhuman AI god can, with its last post-death dying breath, take over his mind and use it to trigger the countermeasure.
Right.
To what is it? Wipe out how many millions of civilizations
A lot.
in order to save the remains of the free galaxy from the blight?
It purges the network.
Well,
And it turns out that the zones of thought are there in order to periodically
yes,
purge the network
yes,
when
yes,
light-like things start taking over.
yes. And as opposed to the Pham Nguyen in the Deepness on the Sky is simply someone with serious kind of wife and mommy problems, right?
Yes.
Truly serious ones that he eventually does manage to work through somewhat over the course of the book.
But a Deepness in the Sky, I love the social theory that planetary civilizations rise in isolation, and you basically you need these authoritarian local bullies to create technology, and then eventually they get over their skis and get too authoritarian, and then they have to collapse, and then the traitors have to exist to take their ideas somewhere else. That's a
Yes.
cool idea. I don't have any idea if that's real, but that's cool.
It
I love
may
it.
be based on, is it Tainter's book, The Collapse of Complex Societies?
Oh
That
yeah,
is,
a little bit.
yeah, that
Well, fused with sort of Vinge's, 80s libertarian instincts.
right, which is not something that I've ever managed to get into or find terribly, terribly attractive, right? That
Yes.
Personal nuclear weapons are definitely a bridge too far.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's funny that our favorite science fiction author was, such a Reagan libertarian when we are not. We are against
Yes,
that.
but it is, I think, an important lesson, that people are always mixed and that one should strive to maximize areas of agreement so that one can actually learn and help, rather than require a blight-like uniformity of thought, belief, and action.
Yes.
That, as Josiah Ober says, the marvelous thing about democracy was precisely because in classical Athens, not everyone thought alike. And so, as opposed to Sparta, or as opposed to the empire of the great king, the Achaemenid, in which you only say what is approved, you only think what is approved, Athens was able, for a while at least, to figure out better ways of doing things by combining multiple perspectives.
Yeah.
And that's a valuable thing for an anthology intelligence to try to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Rather than thinking that the thought of a 77-year-old grifter on the one hand, or of a, how old is Xi Jinping now? 65?
Xi Jinping? No. Xi Jinping's 70.
He's 72?
No, he's not 72. I think he's 70. Hold on, let me
70.
look up
Okay.
exact. Hold.
Good God, then the
He's 70.
senile Chinese emperor problem is coming faster than I thought.
71 next
All
month.
right, yes, the senile Chinese emperor problem is definitely
Oh
coming
no. Xi
faster than I thought.
Jinping, yeah, no, he's and he was never the smartest guy. He's the George W. Bush of China. He's the decider, and he sort of failed up.
And then was the only person with a huge social network as the only prince or one of the few princelings allowed to actually gain some kind of power. And
But anyway,
presumably he was allowed to gain some kind of power because no one thought he was really threatening
right.
at the earlier stage.
So let's briefly talk about Rainbow's End, which is different than other Vinge books. We didn't even talk about The Peace War and Marooned in Real Time, which are amazing books but have essentially no modern relevance,
Right.
except for the fact that people have a swarm of drones
They're
constantly buzzing
swarming,
around them
swarms
that
of
they use to
drones are
fight.
great.
Yeah,
Yes.
swarm of drone, personal drone swarm, that's cool. Otherwise, not relevant, to modern stuff very much.
Okay.
But Rainbow's End really is, because it's about the future of work. And it's about the future of work with distributed individual creators, basically using AR to, it's all about augmented reality. So the whole thing is about augmented reality. And it's about how that will allow people to collaborate seamlessly across nations, and about continuing education, about how old people have to go to high school to like learn how to use new tools. Obviously, that's an exaggeration of reality, but it's
No, do
definitely,
that.
it's this idea of overlapping J curves of, technology.
And it takes place next year.
It takes place next year. That's
It
right.
takes place next year. And it's
Right.
and the conceit is that Robert Gu has had Alzheimer's and his brain is now being rewired by biotechnology, so he no longer has Alzheimer's. But society has been so drastically changed while he's been the Dean of the Deep Freeze that,
It is a Rip Van Winkle story.
yes, a Rip Van Winkle story. And that you have your Apple Vision Pro, but it doesn't look like a three times the size pair of ski goggles, but instead like normal glasses.
Right. No,
And,
it's contact lenses.
oh, you're right, contact lenses. And you simply interact with the world, with a world that is and is not around you via contact lenses, your contact lenses.
Right.
Very much like, if I may give a plug for, Walt John Williams novel, right?
Which
No,
one?
is that it? The novel Aristoi.
Oh, Aristoi. Yeah, that is Walter John Williams.
Walter John Williams.
I haven't read that one. I've only read his like Dread Empire books or whatever.
Oh, you should read Aristoi, if only because
I'll read
it
Aristoi.
starts very much in the Rainbow's End universe.
Oh, cool.
At least it starts in the Rainbow's End universe for the elite of society, who are people who can dissociate themselves into eight different personalities and have each of those eight personalities time sharing their brain, and so are able to accomplish eight positions as a normal
This
person.
is basically just called caffeine. But
No,
anyway,
it's not caffeine because it's eight different personalities, each of them running independent threads of cognition and action.
I don't know how you experience caffeine.
I see.
But
Okay, all right. All right,
all
all right.
right, but what I love about Rainbow's End, besides the fact that the emergent AI that emerges from the internet naturally, by the way, the idea that that AI would be an emergent thing from the internet itself, that was amazing. I don't know any other authors who wrote that, at least not until decades later. Like,
No.
Vinge thought that that AI would just emerge from all this stuff that we were writing to each other. And that's how ChatGPT works. That's how LLMs work. That's so cool.
How does Skynet emerge?
It's just an expert system. They just build it.
Ah, okay.
It's
But
just a computer that can do a lot of trees.
But in True Names, it's essentially the same thing, except that it's this one that's the mailman,
Right.
as a
Yes,
central
he
process
emerges.
node, as a central processing node taking over the
Yes.
network.
Right. By 2006, there were other people doing this trope, right? There was Charles Stross, there were other people, but True Names in what, 1984, I think? Yeah, 1984, he has AI emerging naturally from all the shit that we write on the internet. How did he know? I don't know. It was great.
No, except that it's again, Alex Krantz. It's loquacious. It's not intelligent. And the answer is so far. Answer one is so far. It's loquacious, but not intelligent. And answer two is how about you? You're
Fair
pretty
enough,
much more loquacious than you're intelligent as well.
well, maybe we're all a little bit more loquacious than we are intelligent. But okay, so what I really love about Rainbow's End, but I love the AR stuff, I love the future of work stuff. The emergent AI is cute because it's a rabbit. But what I really love about about Rainbow's End is that it's about what a good life is. So it's there's the thing where you go back to high school, but there's this idea that you can, with modern technology, you can fix the mistakes earlier in your life of your life. And there is definitely, you can absolutely see Werner Vinge writing this as sort of an apology for screwing up his first marriage with Joan D. Vinge.
Okay.
There
It's
that
possible. It's possible. It's possible.
it's that that message is clear.
Authors have some autonomy and are not always their characters.
Yes, but in this
And
case,
even when they are most like their characters, they are riffing off of their characters and becoming more extreme versions of their characters.
yeah, yes. But I felt that I saw the most into that Rainbow's End offered me more of a glimpse into Werner Vinge the person than any other thing that he ever wrote.
Okay, that may well be true. All right.
And I think we've now come to the end of things that we love about Vinge that we plan to say today, although I'm sure we could say more.
Oh, we could say much, 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 much more. I think we should do deep dives at some point into the future into hell, into everything. I would definitely like to do a deep dive into fire. I would definitely like to do a deep dive into deepness. Rainbow's End, I think I could do half a deep dive into, and True Names.
We
Although not
should.
as much True Names, but True Names and the internet and computers as the realm of fairy. Definitely, definitely belong there.
Yes.
Like I know one of the most remarkable passages that at least I think it's a remarkable passage this year is in literature, is in The Lord of the Rings, when at one point Gandalf appears disheveled, having just had his first encounter with the Balrog, although he doesn't know it was the Balrog, and he's was the rear guard, and he comes running up to the Fellowship, and he's clearly in a bad state, and he tries to explain what happened. And he starts talking wizard technical jargon
Yes.
a paragraph before thinking,
Yes.
these people have absolutely no idea what I am talking about, what I am doing. That there are
Yes.
only six Maya on the planet Earth or on Middle Earth right now, including Sauron, who could understand what I am saying here in my full wizard persona. I better get these people out of trouble.
Indeed.
And we should definitely do that.
Yes.
I guess I am somewhat immune to the singularity virus because I don't really think that a game of chess or go is a good model for how people think and act. And I do think that almost all human intelligence is not in individual brains, but is in the network. Is that we're very smart as an anthology intelligence, and whatever AIs we create will be much smarter when they're tied into the network as useful and cooperative parts in it than as, sinister gods out on their own plotting. Plus, there's the other power consideration, right? That there at the moment, there are 8 billion
Humans. Each of us is drawing what, 50 watts of power to run our brains, of which maybe 20 watts is kind of higher cognition rather than kind of body maintenance and visual field stuff. So what, 20 watts times 8 billion? That's 20 kilowatts times 8 million. That's 80 million. That's 160 million kilowatts. And
I don't
what?
have a feel for these ideas, these
No, but
dimensions, but
a single chip from Jensen Huang right now burns a kilowatt. So that they're only right that they're only that all 8 billion of us, they're that basically we are so vastly more efficient than them that and given the sheer number of that you need kind of 100 linked NVIDIA chips in order to carry on, they're part of a chat GPT conversation. They're going to have to build a lot more solar power stations before they can even begin to think like humanity as an anthology intelligence currently thinks, at least with the current neural network hardware architecture.
And they're going to generate a bunch of slop that they then feed on, and this is going to poison them. But okay, regardless of whether or not LLMs are literally the singularity from Werner Vinge's novels, which I think they're not, but because science fiction authors, cyberspace is not what William Gibson and Neal Stephenson predicted.
But it rhymed.
And
But it rhymed.
yes, it rhymed. And
And the blight
mechanized
rhymed.
warfare was not what H.G. Wells predicted.
But it rhymes.
But it rhymes, and I think that a lot of the stuff about AI that we see rhymes with things that
For
Werner
things that are
Vinge
going to
knew.
happen. Yes. All right. Okay. So, key insights.
My key insight is that Werner Vinge is an author that everyone should read and was a man of amazing perspicacity and vision, and possibly the most, one of the best sci-fi authors, but also one of the most underrated. Because you hear people talk about Asimov and Heinlein and Ursula Le Guin and Philip K. Dick and William Gibson and Neal Stephenson and blah blah blah, but Werner Vinge is a boutique taste. He is a hipster thing still, which is why our podcast is called Hexapodia, because we're tremendous hipsters. And it needs Werner Vinge's th stuff needs to be harvested by pop culture and the world, especially because, essentially all of his protagonists are Asian, so it would help with representation to adapt Werner Vinge things for Netflix.
I see. Okay. All right. That sounds like a good thing. And I would say that the key insight seems to be that, the ultimate innovation will indeed be the ability to control human personality and desire. But then we got there 2,500 years ago, to the extent that we would actually listen to our philosophers. And that is kind of the way that at least I understand, not the singularity, which in Vinge's sense I don't seem to under don't see coming, but rather the implications for human society of mammoth amounts of computation and communication power, are bringing to us.
Yes. And I think that one of my key insight from the fact that, Werner Vinge is this 1980s libertarian, and you're almost the opposite of that.
You're right.
And the fact that you guys can get excited in such similar ways about technology and the future tells me that technological progress is a unifying force in society, a thing around which we can unite and both be excited about, perhaps for somewhat different reasons, but in broadly similar ways. And I think that that is encouraging to me, and that it recalls, I think ultimately that's what the 1990s were about. The 1990s were about people from various ideological walks of life all getting excited about roughly the same things.
Right. The Whole Earth catalog and so forth.
Yes.
Yes. Wired magazine. Yes.
Yes. And then we
And
fragmented
in an
again.
earlier
We had a
age,
fragmentation.
and in an earlier age, we had H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. And then too many people got too rich too fast and took over the right libertarian part and turned it into shit. And then we had crypto. Okay.
And yet, crypto is something that Neal Stephenson would love, and perhaps does love.
Well, he would love real crypto, right? I don't think
Yes.
he loves crypto as the grift machine that it currently is.
No, but he would certainly find lots of opportunities for humor.
You would find lots of, all right. Okay. And as always, the final key insight is Hexapodia.
Hexapodia.
Hexapodia is the key insight.
So long, Werner Vinge.
So long, Werner Vinge. I
You
mean, I
will
say
live
we are
forever in our
one.
data stores.
Live as long as the universe endures, or as long as the thrones of the Valar endure in our data stores. But also, of course, but also, we do understand, from special and general relativity, that time is, in some sense, that the universe is not based on time. If the universe is based on anything, it's based on light cones. All right. Okay.
Indeed. All
See you
right.
next time.
Until next time.
Goodbye.